Good evening, and thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Nick Blumberg. As President Donald Trump marks 100 days in office, Governor J.B. Pritzker says Democrats need to get their act together.
I called for people to take out their megaphones and their microphones, to stand up on soapboxes and get to the ballot box.
Pritzker says it's time for, quote, do-nothing Democrats to take the fight to the GOP.
Just because you have disagreement doesn't mean that that's an obstacle. That's called democracy.
Mayor Brandon Johnson bats away accusations he hasn't built strong relationships in Springfield as he lobbies lawmakers for aid to Chicago. Meanwhile, a proposal letting Chicago police implement snap curfews stalls in city council. Juliana Stratton's Senate bid gets a high-profile endorsement, her potential counterpart, Tammy Duckworth. Federal prosecutors do an about-face and drop their attempt to claw back more than $3 million from convicted former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan.
And an old man told me one time, if you do something that you truly love, you never work a day in your life.
Chicago firefighters pay their final respects to Captain David Meyer, killed in the line of duty in an alleged arson. Former Illinois Governor George Ryan dies at the age of 91. And now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Michael Liptrot from Block Club Chicago, Rachel Hinton, also from Block Club Chicago. From WBEZ, we have Lisa Corian-Phillip. And joining us via Zoom, our own Heather Sharon. Let's get right to it. Heather Sharon, George Ryan shares the ignominious distinction of being one of four Illinois governors to go to prison. He also helped pave the way for the abolition of the death penalty. What do you think Ryan's legacy will be?
Well, I think those two things will be inexorably entangled in remembrances of George Ryan. Before he became governor, he had a long career in Springfield serving as Secretary of State, where he committed the crimes that he would be later convicted of. He also served as the House Speaker, and in 1982, almost single-handedly prevented Illinois from ratifying the Equal Rights Amendment, which of course had national political ramifications. But he will be remembered for two things: going to prison for corruption, and that corruption just wasn't any kind of run-of-the-mill Illinois corruption. That corruption led to the death of six children because his office gave a license to an unqualified trucker who was driving an unsafe vehicle that led to a fiery crash that claimed the lives of the six children of the Reverend Dwayne Willis. And of course, at his federal corruption trial, he was accused of clearing death row to distract from the scandal that would soon end his political career. So we remember both, and probably one of the last bipartisan reach across the aisle, run-of-the-mill Republicans Illinois will ever elect to statewide office.
Yeah, certainly not an ideologue, a very pragmatic leader, one that, is perhaps becoming rarer and rarer by the day. Speaking of political leaders that we are paying a lot of attention to, we have crossed the 100-day mark of the second Trump administration, though for journalists trying to keep up with it, it might well feel like it's been longer than 100 days. Heather, sticking with you, what are some of your key takeaways for how Chicago has been affected in these first 100 days?
Well, you know, we would need to be here for at least another hour to sort of tick through all of the things that the ways that the president has targeted Chicago, but he has not fulfilled sort of his initial promises to target Chicago. He vowed to sort of launch his mass deportation efforts in Chicago. Those impacts in Chicago, while severe on the individual level, have not been as widespread as some people feared. He also has been as yet unsuccessful of yanking nearly $3 billion in federal aid from Chicago because it will not stop protecting undocumented immigrants. But this is just the first act of what has already been and promises to be a very, very consequential presidency. And there's no doubt that the president will keep his sights trained on Chicago and other cities led by Democrats like Mayor Brandon Johnson. And it will ultimately be up to the courts and probably the U.S. Supreme Court eventually to decide how successful he will actually be.
Yeah, we heard Governor Pritzker saying he's more worried about the next 100 days, the next 1,000 days. Michael Liptrot, polls now put President Trump's approval rating at historic lows. Do you think that might push the administration to moderate some of its moves that have proven initially unpopular or controversial?
I believe that it's going to definitely come down to how much the focus is on Trump versus the Republican Party, because Trump truly has nothing to lose. He's not trying to build a base for another election, and according to him, he may have another election to come anyway. But as far as the Republican base, they may consider scaling back some of these advances, because realistically, the trade war that's going on, and looking at fears by economists of a recession, looking at the targeting of universities across the country, and just every aspect of American life seeming to have changed in a way throughout this most recent administration taking office. So from federal workers on to college campuses, it's definitely going to be something that the Republican Party has to keep in mind of how they want their perception to be after Trump.
Well, and speaking of the Republican Party, Governor J.B. Pritzker saying Democrats need to take the fight to the GOP. They, you know, can't let Republicans know a moment's peace. Trump advisor Stephen Miller tried to imply that that was sort of an incitement to violence. Rachel Hinton, do you think that argument holds water to your ear? Was that what Pritzker was calling for?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think Pritzker has been very consistent both within these 100 days and also in 2016 about bringing the fight, quote unquote, to Trump, bringing it to the things that he's fighting for, to tariffs, to also laying out the various ways that Trump's policies affect or hurt Illinoisans. I think, you know, thinking of that street fighter comment that he made, I think maybe in January or February, a while ago, I think that's more so a like rallying cry from the governor to, you know, the Democrats obviously need to get their house in order. Within several polls, 60% of like independents disapprove of Trump, but also 76% of those same independents believe that Democrats are out of touch. And I think what Pritzker is trying to do there is say, look, we have a lot of things to work on, and we need to be out in the streets, you know, bringing this to every ballot box and to every Republican we can.
Well, and certainly Pritzker doing a lot of work to rally Democrats. A lot of political watchers also thinking that he's potentially gearing up to run for president in 2028. Lisa Curry and Philip, how do you think voters outside of Illinois who don't necessarily know the governor might receive him?
Yeah, I was just talking about this with my editor because we were like, oh, are our friends outside of Illinois talking about him? And I'm sure, you know, with this viral moment he had last weekend of calling the Democrats the do-nothing Democrats, he is raising his national profile. And I think that the way in which he is putting himself out there as a strong opponent of Trump will resonate with people who are looking for a Democratic leader to lead a really strong fight against the president's policies.
Yeah, and he certainly had quite the media blitz in recent days.
Yes.
and months. You know, Heather, Pritzker is, of course, himself a billionaire. Is there any concern among Democrats, perhaps, that he might not represent the struggles of everyday Americans? Or has he kind of already overcome that with his, you know, demonstrated by his popularity here in Illinois?
Well, that certainly is one of the ironies of this, right? Because Pritzker has sort of staked out this place on the bleeding edge of the Democratic Party, appealing to progressives and those who want Democrats to confront Trump at every possible opportunity, while at the same time being a billionaire himself at a time when everybody's talking about the dangers of oligarchy. And, you know, there has certainly been jokes that, of course, it takes a billionaire to confront a billionaire, and of course, referring to Elon Musk, the special advisor to President Trump. But that is something that Pritzker is going to have to address if he does choose to launch a national campaign. It is not going to be an easy fit, but, you know, that is why serving at least two terms as governor will give him a record to sort of point to and say, well, sure, I might have come from a very wealthy family, but you can tell that I've governed with an eye towards the working and the middle classes. And that will certainly be the message that he attempts to get across in a potential presidential run. But first, of course, he's got to decide whether he's going to run for a third term as Illinois governor. And if he doesn't, we saw the scramble that Dick Durbin's retirement set off for the seat in the U.S. Senate. That will be nothing compared to the scramble it sets off if Pritzker decides to not run for re-election as governor, but run for president.
If I may ask something. It definitely doesn't hurt, even if he hasn't decided what direction he's going in. Similar to seeing AOC on the road with Bernie Sanders for their tour. And it's interesting seeing Pritzker in a way bucking a lot of the expectations you would have of both a politician and a Democrat. And in this post-Trump era of politics, it's something to see that, because the traditional ideas of what political correctness was, to have a billionaire governor go out and say, I'm mad as hell, 30 years ago, that would be unheard of.
The pearl clutching that would have gone
right
on.
And so to say that, to appeal to the working class, just the universal feeling people have of being mad as hell, and the Democrats, in a way, throughout Kamala Harris's campaign, people felt like the Democrats lost that connection to the everyday American.
Yeah.
And it's something where I see Pritzker, regardless of his political direction, working to get in touch with the working class, despite everything that he has, that people will be easy to dismiss him as being distant.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, you know, maybe if he leans into sort of his, you know, his background, you know, his wealth. He had that line at the DNC, like, take it from an actual billionaire, kind of trying to get a dig in at Donald Trump. You know, one of the big moves that we've been following from the Trump administration have been all the pressure on international students. Lisa, you wrote this week about a UIC student from India whose status was revoked, then restored. What's the latest with that student?
So he is back in India, and, you know, as much as he loves the U.S. and really, like, credits his time here to changing, you know, just to give an example, he had planned to go into computer science because his Indian parents were really pressuring him to do that, and he was able to come to the U.S., pursue a college degree where he was able to explore other things, which maybe he wouldn't have been able to do back in India. So he has this deep love for the education system here, and he would love to be a part of it, but he just does not see a place for him here right now because he's afraid that if he comes back, he could be targeted again in another way, and that's not even, you know, reflecting just the amount of work he would have to go to get his visa reinstated or reapply for another one and come back here. So his plans right now are to stay in India for the meantime and then apply to PhD programs in Germany.
Mm. Yeah, you have to imagine there are a lot of students that are weighing, even if they are able to return, whether they want to.
Yes.
You know, sticking with higher ed for a minute, we also saw this group of Big Ten schools essentially, you know, voting to join a pact to support one another amid pressure from the administration. How much can they actually do?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think you might get a different answer if you talk to a faculty member, right, versus who has signed on to one of these PACs. I think it's a bold public statement, but all these PACs are advisory to the administrations of these universities. So what they're saying is, like, we are calling on our university administrations to come together if one of us is attacked, if one of our universities get attacked by the Trump administration, let's band together and you know, pull our resources in order to mount a real legal battle. But it's on the university leaders to actually, you know, take that up and make that pact real, basically.
Yeah, you have to wonder whether perhaps some of the faculty members had been disappointed by the responses from universities. You know, a lot of folks have been saying that they're kind of caving to pressure, so it could be that the faculty is trying to apply pressure of their own to leadership.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard that from faculty at multiple universities, especially at Northwestern right now, which has been in the crosshairs of the Trump administration a lot over the past few weeks. And right now, faculty there actually have signed their own. It wasn't part of the Big Ten PAC, but their own PAC, kind of calling on their administration to fight back and resist. But again, that's an advisory kind of gesture. So it's really on the leaders to listen to faculty or not.
Yeah. Well, you know, Rachel, we've heard from members of Congress saying they want to see Northwestern's president appear to testify again to discuss the issue of anti-Semitism on campus. Do you think we might see sort of a substantive hearing, or is this, you know, the kind of an issue where they're just trying to haul university leadership into, you know, kind of read them the Riot Act?
Yeah, I believe it'll be more so the riot part of that. I think at this point in this administration, as well as, you know, with the House, you know, being majority Republican, they can kind of do what they want and continue to put pressure on, you know, universities or other officials who aren't towing the line, or who may not be towing the line as much as they'd like them to. And so I think they asked for like a transcript or like a transcribed interview with him, with President Michael Schill. And I think that that's more so to continue to keep pressure on him for his actions, for what they view as potentially like support for the encampment that was there last year.
Well, turning to Springfield for a moment, Heather, Mayor Johnson went down to the state capitol this week with a whole list of asks. Might it be a little late in the session for him to make much headway, or does it seem like the mayor may get some of what he'd like to acquire for Chicago, or achieve, I should say?
Well, time is certainly short. We are staring down a Memorial Day or post-Memorial Day deadline for the state officials to nail down their budget for the next fiscal year. A lot of the hard work took place months ago as they sort of fit together this jigsaw puzzle of a budget, which of course had to close a nearly $3 billion deficit at the state level. So yes, it is late in the game, but the real work, as we all know who cover Illinois politics, is that the work doesn't get done until it has to get done. So these next couple of weeks will be crucial. And the mayor has been clear that he's not asking for big changes or large amount of monies. His asks have been modest, and he's, I think, sort of hoping that with that sort of new, perhaps, approach to sort of dealing with the legislature and dealing with Governor Pritzker, that will prove a little bit more successful than it has in the past, because he has in the past asked for $1 billion more in funding for Chicago schools. That certainly didn't materialize. His requests this time around are much smaller, much more narrower in scope, and much more possible in a really hard budget year for everybody all the way around. Will that sort of, you know, pay off in the end? We won't know until all of the sausage is made.
Well, journalists are deadline driven too, so let's not cast aspersions too much on, on lawmakers. You know, Rachel, one of the mayor's asks was support for the city's shelter system. You also had a deep dive this week on the city's system for helping connect people experiencing homelessness with housing, and the fact that it's kind of opaque about how people are prioritized. What did you learn?
Yeah, this system called the Coordinated Entry System began or was launched in 2017 as a way to kind of help people experiencing homelessness have just one place where they put their name to hopefully be connected to services, as well as potential like referrals or connections to housing. And the people I spoke to about that system feel discouraged. They feel like it's still a shot in the dark about whether or not they're going to get housed. They don't know when it's coming. The you know, officials I spoke to, both from the city as well as All Chicago, which is a city a partner, a nonprofit, say it's very difficult to tell people specifically where they are in the line to get housed, because there is no real line. It's not like, you know, you pull a number at a deli counter and that's your number. There's constantly changing factors and things to consider. But the people I spoke to say that is getting that answer, getting that told to them has been difficult to get. I also looked at how that system interplays with the accelerated moving events, right, which we've seen happen more since COVID. It's the same system used to prioritize people, but those moving events happen in largely in shelters as well as some other encampments to try to both help move people out of shelters to open up beds, and also to try to connect people to housing who might be at higher risk of COVID. The system, you know, has a lot going on within it. It is murky. It's hard to totally understand where you stand in line, but also how do these things work, and are they working as well as they should? The sense I got is people are trying as hard as they can with a few resources they have, a few resources meaning there's not enough affordable housing in the city. But the people I spoke to who are experiencing homelessness say, like, we need something better than this.
Yeah, you can imagine it's got to be a very difficult and frustrating process for a lot of folks. Michael, a proposal to allow Chicago police to put these so-called snap curfews in place hit a roadblock in city council, some concerns that it might not be constitutional, at least as written right now. Do you expect to see this plan revived? Do you think there's still the pressure on Alders to try and get something done here?
There's definitely the pressure. It's still there, especially as we go into the summer months and as we've seen in recent years with the so-called teen takeovers, as they refer to, and just the need to find a solution to young people gathering downtown and the downtown and really across the city, and also the question of how can young people safely gather and not have things escalate to that point. And when it comes to the snap curfew, it's truly in a snap, the idea of being able to set a curfew within 30 minutes and then being able to enforce that for young people, especially when we're talking about people who do not have licenses or cars. That is a big ask for a group of people to be able to leave an area. And so when I think about, if you're at Millennium Park, let's say this, and if you're at Millennium Park and how teenagers gather, one person may say there may be five people there. You show up, someone else has brought five people. Next thing you know, 20 people. That's the threshold right. to be able to have this curfew. And so if you don't expect there to be 20 people, now there's 20 people. A curfew is established. If you come from South Shore, Berwyn Mar, expecting on the Metro, and then on the weekends, the Metro's run every 2 hours. Right. So for you to be able to leave, you may have to wait over an hour to get out. And then buses may get packed. And now with Uber being able to have geofencing around areas, you can't call a rideshare to get out there either. So you likely could have teenagers stranded with police and closing in. And so it begs the question, what is the expectation for these young people to do?
Yep, I think it's going to be a very difficult question for members of the city council to answer if they come up with one. Heather, federal prosecutors are no longer pursuing a forfeiture trial against convicted former House Speaker Michael Madigan. Do we know why they made this kind of sudden about face?
Well, I certainly wish that the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Illinois would call me up and explain their thinking on a whole bunch of issues. But alas, that is not how the Department of Justice works. They have not explained why they no longer want to recover $3.1 million from Michael Madigan that they said was sort of the profit of his criminal conspiracy that led him to be convicted on several, but not all charges in a blockbuster trial that seemed to last forever. But we will have to see sort of what we can gather from the sentencing, which is scheduled for June, and to see if that sheds any more light on. It may be a combination of pressure from Washington, which has made it clear that they do not see political corruption as sort of one of their major points of inquiry. It may be that the Department of Justice thinks that because it was such a split verdict from the jury, they don't want to sort of continue to make these arguments. It's really impossible to tell, but it is good news for Madigan, who, of course, will be able to keep that money and use it to sort of continue to fund his criminal defense and any appeals if he should choose to appeal his guilty verdicts and potentially to pay for what his defense could be in a retrial on those counts that the jury did not reach a verdict in.
We've got about a minute left, but I want to get to this. Juliana Stratton this week landing the endorsement of her potential colleague, Senator Tammy Duckworth. Rachel, are you at all surprised to see folks like Duckworth and Governor Pritzker jumping in with endorsements so quickly?
I'm a little surprised, but I'm not surprised about Governor Pritzker. They've worked together. They know each other. It makes sense for him to support his lieutenant governor. I'm a little surprised by Duckworth. Although, you know, I'm sure a lot of things are happening behind the scenes to warrant that early endorsement. But I'll be curious to see how this plays out and who else jumps in the race. One thing I find kind of interesting, I don't know if people saw, but NBC's Marian Ahern came out with a story about, you know, how Governor Pritzker is allegedly bullying, and trying to, like, you know, throw his political clout around, saying that Representative Lauren Underwood is damaged goods to try to, like, you know, move people away from her camp to Lieutenant Governor Stratton's camp. And I think, it wouldn't be Illinois politics without both allegations of bullying and also potentially bullying. So I'll be very curious to see how this works out.
Well, it has worked out very well having the four of you on the panel tonight. But unfortunately, we are out of time. So our thanks to Michael Liptrot, Rachel Hinton, Lisa Corian Phillip, and Heather Sharone. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Tonight's presentation of Week in Review is made possible in part by Ann and Rich Carr, BNSF Railway, and Francine and Dr. Anthony Brown. Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by
And that's our show for this Friday night. If you're still figuring out your plans for this weekend and need a little inspiration, be sure to check out our summer festival guide. Summer will be here soon, we promise. It highlights events of all sizes, from street festivals and art shows to outdoor concerts and cultural celebrations across Chicago and the suburbs. And you can find it at WTTW.com/festivals. Now for the Week in Review, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay informed. Have a great weekend. All right, Lisa, next week we're watching out for collections are restarting on defaulted student loans. What do folks need to know?
Yes, so folks need to know that basically, you know, you haven't been collected on for 5 years. Potentially, if you've defaulted on your loans, you haven't made a payment in more than 270 days.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.